Hey there, friends. Welcome to the first episode of Seminary Dropout in 2017. I know that some of you were wondering what happened to Seminary Dropout, if it was over and done with. I really want to say thank you to all of you who sent me messages and wondering if there was going to be more Seminary Dropout and worried that there wasn't going to be. Back in November, I did an intentional hiatus that I thought was just going to be for the month of December. But here we are, it's April, and I'm just now getting back to new Seminary Dropout episodes. Part of that was some things that I just kind of miscalculated, thinking I would have more time than I did. And some of that was just, you know, life circumstances coming up. But I always intended to bring back more Seminary Dropout. Some of you might know, during this time, Kate and I had our second child. We're really excited to welcome Amos to the world. He's 7 weeks old now. We're having a lot of fun with him. Also, we've done some home renovations, things like that, just life. And then some of you may know that I launched with a friend of mine a new podcast called On Ramp. And if you haven't listened to On Ramp, please go listen to On Ramp. Subscribe. I am so proud to be a part of it. It's with me and a friend of mine, Carrie Fisher. She is a social work professor in the university setting and has a wealth of knowledge. And so On Ramp is us sitting down, talking, having really frank conversations about race. And our desire for On Ramp is for that to be a tool. So if people in small groups and their churches or kind of things like that would want to listen to that together, I think it's a fantastic resource. And like I said, I'm so proud of it. Just a place for people to learn about race, about reconciliation, that sort of thing. We do hope to do a second season of that, but just the first season is out. It's just, I think, 11 episodes. So please go check out On Ramp. Now, I want to talk a little bit about just Seminary Dropout in this new season. It's, like I said, first episode of 2017. And there's going to be a few little changes here and there. I think the things that you like about Seminary Dropout will certainly be the same. We're welcoming a new sponsor, which I'm about to talk about. Hopefully keeping all the old sponsors. I just want to say thank you because I feel like Seminary Dropout has the best listeners ever. Like, you really, you value things that are good for the show. And so whenever I've announced a new sponsor, I've got nothing but good feedback. People don't see that as a burden or interrupting their show. They know that it's good for the health, the growth of the show. And so they are generally glad about it and celebrate with it. So I just want to thank you for that. So the new sponsor for Seminary Dropout is Compassion International. It was so cool how this happened several months back. Someone from Compassion International contacted me, Tom Evans, who's kind of in charge of that sort of thing there at Compassion, contacted me out of the blue. I think he had heard one of the episodes of Seminary Dropout and said he wanted to kind of, explore the possibility of a partnership. Little did he know that I'm a huge fan of Compassion International, that Kate and I have sponsored two kids for almost a decade in Compassion. And so, I was really excited about that. And then he said, also, I'm taking a trip of people to Sri Lanka later on, and I'd like to extend to you an invitation for that. Traveling internationally is something I've always wanted to do. I only got to do it just a very few times. And also to do it with Compassion to see what they do there. I was excited about it. So there will be an episode coming up maybe next week, probably next week, that will, I'll tell you about my trip. I have a conversation with my friend Sam, who also works at Compassion, who was also on that trip, just about it and about what Compassion did there. I'm so excited about that. If you're interested in sponsoring a child, you can go to compassion.com/dropout, and that'll support the show. That'll obviously support children all over the world, and you can read about what they do. Like I said, next week, I'm really excited to bring to you the episode all about my trip with Compassion in Sri Lanka. It's such an amazing organization. And I say this in the episode, but You know, if I'd seen some things that I didn't like there, I would have had no problem coming back and saying, hey, Compassion, thanks for the trip. Thanks for all you do, but I don't think I want to partner with you. But I was so impressed with everything that they did there. So I can't wait for you to hear all about that in that episode coming up, like I said, probably next week. So yeah, that's that. Let's get on with the show. Welcome back to Seminary Dropout. First episode of 2017. I think it's going to be a great year of shows. I've got a bunch of them already recorded, lined up, ready to go. I can't wait for you to hear it. Here we go. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go. My guests are Jamin Goggin and Kyle Strobel. Kyle is an assistant professor of spiritual theology and formation at Talbot School of Theology at Biola University. And Jamin is a pastor at Mission Hills Church. Jamin and Kyle, thanks for being with me.
Thanks, man. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us on.
So we're here to talk about your new book, The Way of the Dragon, The Way of the Lamb, Searching for Jesus' Path of Power in a Church That Has Abandoned It. I wonder if each of you can remember the first time that you realized that the church had a problem with its relation to power. Was it maybe early on when you were growing up in the church, or did it come on sometime after that?
You know, I think there were some things, probably, I'm guessing for both of us, that we saw early on, but we didn't have the categories biblically and theologically to think about them as issues of power specifically. And I think what probably really did it for both of us is when we were in seminary, Jamin and I were both in seminary together doing two different kind of master's degrees. And one of the master's degrees we were in together was New Testament. And when you're studying the New Testament, you're so constantly focused on Jesus and on Paul's reflection of Jesus. And if you went to seminary like we did with a bit of grandiosity, with maybe a little more of a desire to be great and to be powerful yourself, that gets very difficult because you constantly are reading Jesus saying things like, well, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And, you know, my grace is made perfect in weakness, or my power is made perfect in weakness, not in strength. And without me, you can do nothing. And so, you know, for the time when we were kind of training for ministry, we were constantly being confronted with the reality that, man, I believe this in one sense, but there's a part of me that isn't interested in weakness, that isn't interested in this way. And so that really led us into an exploration of why are we so interested in the opposite way? And why do we see so many people around us? And I think maybe the kind of final straw, so to speak, was, you know, I think the Lord didn't allow Jamin and I to live in our flesh in ministry as long as we would have on our own, certainly. And we had a lot of people around us who the Lord let do that. And we saw people go into ministry and destroy their lives, quite honestly, and destroy their ministries. And as we looked at them, it became clear to us, this isn't beyond me. I could have done this. And we really had to be confronted with, how do we rethink what we're about? And how do we understand, well, what is the church about? What is Jesus's way of power if it's not this?
Yeah, and I think, Shane, what I'd add to that is Kyle and I both, again, an experience of God inviting us into what we call in the book downward mobility, and kind of a stripping bare of the accoutrements of success and achievement and what we expected to happen as we kind of grew in ministry, as we went to seminary, as we built our resumes. For both of us, it kind of landed at similar seasons of life with different circumstances. For me, it was after 3 years of ministry, my first job in pastoral ministry, losing my job. And the church was struggling financially, and yet I was expecting to kind of remain on staff. And so kind of unexpectedly lost my position. But on top of that, wasn't able to find another job. And I can distinctly remember in that season, kind of the grandiosity in my heart really, really coming to the surface. Man, don't these people know that I'm supposed to be important and I'm supposed to be on a big stage at some point and I'm supposed to have a big ministry and I've done two master's degrees here and everyone tells me I'm a great teacher. And then for Kyle, similarly, again, different season of life, some different vocational trajectory for him, but coming out of finishing master's work and then PhD work and being the season where he couldn't get a job as a professor and having to wait and sit in a season of unemployment. So in a very real sense, there was a season for both of us where our temptations towards power, for significance, for control, for notoriety, for influence were kind of mirrored to us by not having those things.
Hmm. Kyle, you know, you tell a story about how you taught a class on the Christian worldview at a university.
Yeah.
It was a really unpopular class before you got there, but you kind of turned it around. It became really popular and students really wanted to hear your lectures, but you kind of came to realize that that success was more about the power that it gave you and more about impressing people with your ability than it was educating them. I just thought that story was just a good picture of what, you know, the entirety of the book is about, because so many churches and pastors do the same thing. And I wonder if it was difficult for you to see that for what it was, because, you know, another big problem and another big theme of the book is that most pastors and churches, they mentally kind of intertwine their success with God's success. So yeah. They can at the end say, no, but this is all for God's glory. So however we get there is good because it's for God.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that it was interesting, you know, that season, it's so, it, you know, one of the things that kind of exposed to me is how easy it is to slip into what we call the way from below with good motivations. You know, my motivations by and large were good. I had good goals in mind. I wanted to captivate these students with the gospel. I wanted to, you know, about 40% of my classes were unbelievers. And I'm like, wow, this is an incredible opportunity. I have a whole semester to cast a vision for what Christianity is about. And then I'd have upperclassmen coming to sit in on the class that they had taken a couple years earlier. I mean, they were just sitting in on it because they had heard good things about it. I'm like, oh, this is great, you know. But it became so easy to just turn to my ability to wow them. And then exactly what you said, to think, yeah, but and this is what God, look what God is up to. When I full well knew, no, look, this is what I'm up to. I had turned this class into a one-man play. And I was on stage and I was impressing them. And yet the temptation is so real, I think, because I could constantly turn to my good ends, my good motives, and say, well, therefore it can't be bad, right? It has to be positive, it has to be good, it has to be. And it really wasn't until I really started reflecting a bit on what am I even doing? What is the goal really of what I'm up to? And I think in the church, it's probably even easier. You know, in the church, as long as I'm getting good feedback on my sermons, as long as people aren't leaving or positively are showing up and keep showing up and we're growing or whatever it is, I mean, it's so tempting to just look at the numerical kind of statistics and say, I'm doing well because these are doing well.
Well, I mean, you see stories about churches doing things like giving away cars on a Sunday morning or like ordering pizza and then dragging the delivery person on stage to give them like $1,000 tip.
Wow. Okay.
Oh man, like YouTube it. There's tons of YouTube videos of churches doing that. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And it seems like they're really mimicking like publicity stunts that a for-profit business might do.
Yeah.
And definitely not modeling biblical principles, you know, at least doing good deeds in private and stuff like that. But I mean, I think it's so elusive for churches like that because they see, you know, one, oh, all these people heard about us through this thing that we did. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, hey, we had a convert that day. Like,
totally.
I feel like churches are really bad about saying, if quote unquote someone was one for Christ, then who cares how we got there?
Yeah.
Kind of mentality.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing to me how quickly and how easily we justify our means in almost any way we want, as long as we got out of it what we think we should have. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why our expectations have to be recalibrated around the way of Jesus and, of course, the cross. I mean, if grandiosity is an expectation, well, sure, you're going to be able to justify all sorts of things. If love and the cross are your expectations, well, that's going to recalibrate how we're justifying what we're up to.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm sure we'll maybe get into this a bit later, but one of the pieces that is central to our book is this kind of literal pilgrimage we went on to visit with sages of the faith, glean wisdom from them about the state of the church, about what it means to embrace power and weakness for the sake of love. And one of those sages in particular stands out to me as we're talking about this is Dallas Willard. And one of Dallas's, you know, Dallas is known for these really great axioms of wisdom. Can't really refer to them as pithy because a philosopher is very intentional about his words, right? And so very thoughtful about his words. But Dallas is prone to say it this way, that it's not just about doing Jesus things, but doing them Jesus's way, right? Mm-hmm. And that our demonstration of the gospel is born out in our methodology, and that faithfulness is to be the plumb line all the way through, right? And this is, you know, one of the chapters we explore in the book, kind of Paul's tension with those that were known as the super apostles, right, as he's writing to the Second Corinthians. And what's so kind of telling about this discourse back and forth, and of course, Paul's theme of power and weakness, the power known as a way of embracing Jesus' way of the cross that he develops all throughout 2 Corinthians, is kind of grounded in this contextual backdrop where we have these so-called super apostles coming in who look very different than Paul, right? And here you have a church that's kind of questioning Paul's apostolic authority because he doesn't exude the kind of cultural forms of power that they would expect. He's not kind of using the means they would think he should employ to kind of get kingdom work done. So, and he acknowledges this all throughout the letter, right? He intentionally doesn't appeal to certain forms of rhetoric to kind of get the job done. He doesn't take money from them, which was viewed as a sign of kind of dishonor, right? And a teacher is worth their salt because they're taking money. And all throughout, there's this kind of constant parallels between these super apostles, these other teachers that have come into town, and their kind of means of proclaiming what the power of the gospel and is all about, and then Paul's. And so much of it rests on methodology, so much of it rests on posture, so much of it rests on means. And for Paul, this is the crux of the matter, right? His concern with the super apostles, that ultimately he's going to say that they have embraced the way of the devil in their behavior. And ultimately he's going to say that they're kind of leveraging their own talents and abilities, their own rhetoric, as voiding the cross of its power, right? That one's methods really matter, that the gospel is at stake in these matters.
Well, I think it makes it all the more important that I think our understanding of what salvation is so important, because if we view it as introducing someone to the way of the cross and to the way of Christ, well, then obviously the means that we get there can't violate that, can't be contrary to that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this journey that you guys went on. You went and spent time with 7 different people, mm-hmm. very, very wise and amazing people. Let's start off. One of the first ones that you saw was J.I. Packer. And one of the things that he told you that stuck with me was he discussed what he called the idolatry of specialness.
Yeah.
Can you break that down a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, Packer, this struck us as well as we were sitting with him. And I think not only in our own experience, but even in our own hearts in many ways, this desire, you know, he's worried that churches have this deep desire in the flesh to be special. And so when we hire a pastor, we're not looking for a shepherd of our community, someone that will embody the way of the cross. We're looking for someone who will make us special because of their greatness. Mm. When we worship, we're not looking for proper, I think as he put, kind of face on the floor worship. We're looking for special worship. And Packer seemed to think that there's this sense, and I kind of think of it along the biblical model of the flesh, that in the flesh, there's this deep desire to be special that's tied into the desire to be great. And he's constantly worried that the church has given in to the desire to be special. And if you're special, several things are going to happen, right? You're going to have this elitism that develops. You're going to start competing with other churches. You're going to have to do quite a lot of selling, quite honestly, if you're special. Right? Yeah. If you're longing to be special, and if you are special, you're going to have a hard time seeing the truth of yourself. Right? Mm. And this is where you get, I think, in the church, this commodification of excitement. Like, how do we maintain excitement? Because if we're not excited, we might wake up and realize maybe we're not that special after all. And maybe that church across that, maybe they're more special because look at the great things going on there. And the entire discussion, what struck us is, Packer's showing us that this register we're in of specialness is entirely antithetical to the way of Jesus.
Yeah, I think even as we're talking about it, Shane, what comes up for me is, I think what Packer identified is that Babel is in our hearts, right? We desire to make a name for ourselves. And this is a very old temptation, goes all the way back to the garden, right? And we see it in our churches today as well. And we shouldn't be surprised by this. I think the way Packer refers to it is that being special is the Achilles heel of many churches today. And I mean, Kyle's narrated it well. I think it shows up in a myriad of forms. I think one is the way we tend to view our pastors and those in leadership, the reasons why we hire them, the reasons why some people are elevated to the main guy position or not. It usually is based on gifting, a sense of, I've even, as I've been a pastor now for many years, I can think back to a conversation with a friend in ministry who I think really shepherded faithfully, was committed to the word, had a prayerful posture in his ministry, but was told he wasn't going to kind of excel and move up to the next level of leadership in the church because he didn't have the it factor. And whatever the it factor means. But I think it has a lot to do with this, right? You're lacking that kind of special quality that will cause people to kind of want to follow or attach to you or kind of gather a crowd. And I think it shows up in a variety of ways. Kyle just mentioned some of them, but it shows up in our churches when we celebrate our accomplishments and have very little to say about God's involvement in them. It shows up in our churches when we spend our time analyzing and measuring and calculating through metrics our growth for the sake of making it clear that we've done something and we've gotten somewhere. It shows up in our surveys and magazines and other places comparing sizes of churches, both in total as well as how rapid they've grown. It shows up in our functional sainting of celebrities who happen to be Christians and our putting of them behind a pulpit, even though we have no reason to believe they'll be faithful in handling God's word. It shows up in a lot of places, right? It shows up in our conferences where the powerful and the anointed, quote unquote, are on stage, primarily because they're the people who have grown the biggest ministry or the biggest church at the quickest pace at the youngest age. And these are all signs or byproducts of an idolatry of specialness or making a name for ourselves.
At one point in the book, there was, Jamin, you told this great story about having a conversation with a pastor, and he said, a smart, productive atheist could do my job well.
Yeah.
One, like, I'm surprised that a pastor would admit that.
Yeah.
It's a humbling moment, no doubt.
It wasn't on stage at a conference.
Right. I know. But I've had such similar thoughts seeing how some churches function and thinking, this pastor is really just an entrepreneur, Like, he has those skills and there's nothing wrong with that, but we're really missing something if it stops there, right? Yeah. And if we're just building this thing, and it might as well be a company, it might as well be Amazon, or it might as well be Apple, and our pastor is just a leader simply because he knows how to get a lot of people to buy this product.
Right.
I mean, that's really scary.
Yeah, it is. And I think, what hopefully comes through in the book is, for Kyle and I, the beginning of the conversation is a prayerful, self-reflecting one, right? That, I think we can identify some of these things on the horizon of the landscape of the evangelical church that we're a part of more broadly. But the truth is, it's not just a problem for megachurch pastors or guys that run multi-site churches or guys that write, blogs called the Entrepreneur Pastor. I don't know if there is such a thing. But, I can think back of my first few years in ministry, being a youth pastor, of a very small youth group in a small church, and yet having the very same kind of drives and motivations of significance and notoriety and recognition, as well as kind of appealing to a power source that primarily was grounded in my own gifting and abilities and or education and kind of know-how. And the truth is, this is, you know, it's not a temptation that's just kind of before those who are in big, powerful, important positions. It's a temptation before all of us who are in positions of leadership.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that Eamon and I realized is when we were younger, it was very easy for us just to demonize the people that had made it.
Yeah.
Quote unquote, you know, to say, oh, those are the people that are a problem. And and yet, you know, one of the funny things, I'm an academic, and, you know, even in academic circles, you know, a study just came out that said the average academic article is read by 8 people. And yet, nonetheless, it's like, yeah, that might have only been read by 8 people, but I got it in that journal, right? And I can, you know, that temptation's there for me just as much as it's there for someone who's selling, you know, 10 million copies of their book. They might have more opportunity to let it vent, maybe, but the temptation is always there. And I think what we're hoping to call people into is that, look, the temptation of power isn't just for the leaders. This is for everything we do. And I think the fact that Jesus's recalibration of the kingdom around the power system of love does so many things, but one of the things it does is it forces the conversation on all of us of how am I seeing my power? How am I kind of recognizing it? How am I evaluating it? How am I resting upon it? Like, how do I sense what it means to be powerful in the way of Jesus? Is that being driven by the register of love? Or in fact, am I actually kind of employing worldly matrix to think about how great I am, or how successful I am, or how impressive I am, whatever it is, no matter what I'm doing, no matter how small my circle of influence is, and that no matter how little that is, I could be tempted just as much as anyone else.
One of the other people that you interviewed was Marva Dawn. And for those listening, if you don't know these people, we won't dive too much into their resumes, but it's definitely worth Googling them and maybe checking out some of their writings and things like that. One of the things that Marva contributed to the conversation was that this idea that this misuse of power or the wrong kind of power by the church was really demonic. And she just believed there's a lot of spiritual warfare going on. It seemed like that was kind of a new element to the conversation that you hadn't really explored before.
Yeah. I think, you know, there was a genuine kind of palms open receptivity as we sat at the feet of each of these sages that we spent time with. And each of them, I think in their own way, shaped and informed the trajectory and direction of the book in ways unexpected. But I think we could probably safely say the Marva interview was the biggest shift.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can distinctly remember the point in the conversation as we were talking about the powers and principalities of darkness, and she was kind of unpacking how we properly identify them, how we properly name them, what they are, and she began to narrate, you know, how she's seen and experienced this at pastors' conferences, and she talked about kind of being in the back in the green room at a conference she was speaking at, and kind of watching other pastors jockeying for kind of influence and position with one another, both maybe just in body language as well as in direct conversation, right? And comparing sizes of ministries and influences and platforms. And she turned to me and asked a simple question. Do you know what I was thinking? I thought, well, quite honestly, Shane, I kind of thought, well, yeah, it's sad, but I've seen this my whole life. And, you know, I've been a part of it too. And, you know, okay, you know, and her answer really took me back. I said, no. And she said, I was thinking this is demonic. And that really was a significant turning point for us, that interview, and even that moment of the interview, the conversation that sent us on a whole other trajectory. And interestingly enough, our grounding passage for the book, or one of our main grounding passages from Scripture for the book, James 3, explicitly narrates this. And Kyle and I had picked up on it, but really hadn't honed in on it until that moment. And James narrates these kind of two ways of power we talk about in the book, the way from above and the way from below. And as James talks about the way from below, he calls it earthly unspiritual and demonic. This is a way that's marked by selfish ambition, jealousy, the kinds of things we've been talking about, right? And power to control and dominate. But when James identifies this, he says its source is that which is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. And of course, in the history of the church now, we've kind of captured that, and we have an axiom we call the world, the flesh, and the devil, right? To talk about these things. And I think if I'm honest, I probably have historically viewed these problems within the church that we're talking about as mostly being issues of the flesh and individual pride and kind of zeal for power. And that's certainly there. But I think to the neglect of recognizing the very real spiritual warfare that is at work here, right? That when we choose to embrace a way that is opposed to the cross of Jesus, a way that is opposed to power found in weakness for the sake of love, when we appeal to this power and autonomy for the sake of control or dominating or winning, we're actually choosing the way of the demonic. And there's a scene in the Gospels that really vividly mirrors this, right? Where Jesus has called Peter to follow him. And I can only imagine, you know, in the Gospel of Mark, there's that kind of the speed and pace of that gospel with the word immediately used over and over again. You get the sense of Peter really being whisked along after Jesus calls him to follow him. He's seeing miracles and signs and wonders and amazing teaching. Of course, they're facing some opposition, but at this point, Peter's thinking, this is pretty cool. I mean, look what I get to be a part of, right? Look where this thing is headed. And then we get to that moment in Mark 8 where Jesus furnishes for him a more detailed description of where this thing actually is headed. And he says, I'm going to go to the cross. I'm going to suffer and I'm going to die. And of course, Peter rebukes him, right? Corrects him. And giving all of us who are prone to speak too quickly, like myself, a sense of courage. He rebukes Jesus. And Jesus' response is, quite incredibly, get behind me, Satan. You do not have the things of God in mind, but the things of man, right? And what we see there is that the world and the flesh and the devil are all kind of interlocking realities at work here, that opposing the way of the cross, opposing Jesus' way of power, is actually not only fleshly and worldly, as Jesus says there, but ultimately is demonic.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think with, you know, as in terms of our own development, our own journey, you know, it's not unusual today, you know, in the publishing industry, it's not unusual to have to write a book in about 6 months. That on a popular Christian level, that's kind of somewhat standard now. And, you know, Jamin and I, to kind of try to mirror this, our kind of message in the mode, we took about 6 years to write this, in part because we wanted to feel the weight of these interviews. And the Marva one was a big turn, you know, and everything we had said and kind of done up to that point led this direction. But when she said it, right, that you feel it in the book, as you said, right? It's like, wow, this is something now new. And it's a turn that once you make it, I think you begin to see it like, yeah, this is what you have to say. But even saying it, when we turned to, wow, these, it's not that just that the church is giving into these things has been unfortunate. Because we look around, you know, you see this all over the place, right? We see pastors cheating the New York Times bestseller list. We see some of the things you mentioned in terms of these kind of scam type things getting people in the door. We look at this stuff and it's like, yeah, I wish people weren't doing that. And that's probably not ideal. And it's like, no, Jesus is much harsher about this. And if our call in part is to stand firm in the evil day, as Paul will say, is to stand against the powers and principalities, we have to be able to name them. Mm. And I think that means naming them in the church as well. And so that interview really did shake us up a bit. And I think what it led us to, again, this is not based on our own strategies or our own abilities or anything. What, you know, we were writing a book on the power in weakness. And what became clear to us is that power and weakness is how you stand firm against the powers and principalities. Mm. And that these things weren't two separate conversations. I think at first it felt a little to us like, wow, this is just a different conversation. Mm. And it became clear biblically for us, actually, no, this is the same conversation. And we just don't see anyone having them together, that they've been separated. And I think that's a dangerous for both conversations, actually.
You have a chapter where you talk about how racism has a lot to do with the church using the power from below.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because I was kind of surprised to see that in there. Like, I completely thought it was super appropriate, but it was kind of surprising, even though I knew you were going to talk to John Perkins at some point. I don't know what I thought you were going to talk to him about. But I wonder if you could explain the church's culpability in racism. And I think there's a lot of material there historically, but I think it's almost more important to talk about its culpability today in racism.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the heart of the Perkins chapter was the focus on reconciliation. And I think the reality of how is reconciliation more than just kind of a notion that is on paper? I think a lot in my own background, you know, coming up, you know, middle class, suburban, white kind of churches, you know, say, oh, this stuff's over, right? We, you know, yes, in our past, we made some mistakes and kind of now it's done. And the sense that, yeah, we are reconciled. And at no point do I actually have to talk to someone of another ethnic background to ask, are we actually reconciled? Like, is something changed? And, you know, one of the things that struck me when I moved back to Southern California, where I live, is a hugely Asian context. And I literally drive a 10-minute drive from my little town into my work, and I drive by an intersection where every shopping center on every four corner is all in Korean. And what's interesting is that that means I'm surrounded by Korean churches that I don't know anyone that goes to, that I've never stepped foot in, that it's a very unusual context for me. I'm like, I haven't normally been in places where it's that stark, the separation between like, oh, they're over there doing those kinds of things. And maybe praise God for that, but we're just not going to talk to them. You know, we're just going to do our thing over here. And I think that, you know, the biblical church, and by biblical, I mean like the church of the biblical era, they would have been so tempted by this. I mean, you think of the church in Rome, or you think of the church in Galatia, or you think of the church, how easy it would have been to say, you know, why don't the Jews stay over here? And why don't you, Gentiles, why don't you just stay over there? Well, let's do separate churches. Mm. And I think by and large, even though publicly Christians recognize segregation as a real cultural evil, it's basically our MO when it comes to the church. Mm. And I think that is a failure of understanding the depths of reconciliation, the reality of that in Christ, there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. And in part, you know, it's one of the things that struck me as we even wrote this book is it's very easy to oversimplify how difficult of a problem it is in terms of actually fixing it. And I'm not sure there's harder, quite honestly, questions today that the church needs to wrestle with. But as you know, as we sat with John Perkins, you know, sitting there and talking with him, hearing about his struggle, hearing about how he stood against it, I think this is a time when we have to stand against this, and we have to do so non-divisively. We have to do so honestly, and we have to start having those conversations across these borders. Too often, and we note this in the book, like it's too easy for a more affluent white churches usually to kind of think, well, since we're successful, quote unquote, since we have money, since we have status, we have what these other churches need. So what the inner city needs is more of us down there. And what's interesting, you know, Paul has this very peculiar kind of ethic where no one actually has complete lack. And so there's no one 100% needy in Paul's view of the world. Paul views every relationship as reciprocal in the sense that you may have something, let's say money, that means we have something that you need as well. That individual churches like the body of Christ have these kind of different roles within the whole body. And so I think too often we've used worldly metrics again to assume, well, I have what you need, and therefore our giving tends to actually be dehumanizing. And we tend to kind of undercut the very kinds of ministries we're trying to do because we're ministering at other people, even other Christians, rather than opening relationships with them and recognizing we need what you have and you need what I have. But to understand that, we have to be together. And so, you know, in so many different ways, Perkins has awoken us up to very deep questions about what does it even look like to start this conversation? Because even though it's being had in one sense on a more academic basis, on the ground, I just don't see these kinds of things being addressed all that often.
One of the last people that I want to talk about was, and I hope I'm saying this right, Jean Vanier.
Jean Vanier.
Vanier. The French pronunciation of the first name, but it was sure to laugh.
It was kind of a safe middle ground to take.
Yeah. It's a weird half measure. I think he's probably someone that I've heard his name in passing, but honestly didn't know much about him. Mm. He was a friend of Henry Nouwen's, who I think a lot of people know who Henry Nouwen is. Mm-hmm. He really opened up to you about Henry's struggles, his loneliness. What did it mean to you to hear him talk about that?
Yeah, I think for me, in many ways, you know, having read so many of Nouwen's books, and Nouwen has been so instructive in my own understanding of kind of formation and the human person, but also just more personally, his words have been incredibly meaningful for me in my own journey and my prayer life. And I think, interestingly enough, I think probably for both Kyle and I in some ways, Nouwen had kind of been located somewhere in the stratosphere of, you know, he probably in our hearts had kind of been turned into one of these gurus, even for us. And I think the conversation with Jean about Henry, it didn't diminish any of the significance of his words or the importance of his ministry, but it did kind of enflesh him in a way and remind us that he was someone on the journey as well. And hearing Jean talk about Henry wanting to whisk off and write another book or visit another friend instead of staying grounded and present to the community and ministry, and hearing about, you know, his struggle of wanting to be back in places of importance and significance and really having to fight and wrestle with that, and how so much of that desire was born out of a deep-seated loneliness that he needed to attend to in prayer and stay present to rather than trying to escape from. And hearing about his own struggle with that and his journey with that, and that was still something that he was processing with the Lord and with others, was incredibly encouraging to me, you know, that this way of embracing the cross, this way of embracing power and weakness for the sake of love, it's the journey of a lifetime. And, you know, there's a, I'm not going to get the exact quote right, but there's a phrase that has always meant a lot to me, actually, in Henry's writing himself, where he says, where you've grown, you've grown, where you haven't, you haven't. And as someone who can sometimes actually idolize growth and maturity in and of itself as a good, rather than simply the call to abide in Christ as primary and learning to depend upon Christ in my weakness, I think hearing a friend's account of Henry's own process with those things, that in many ways he was a beautiful man who demonstrated the way of Christ in incredible ways. And in other ways, he was still a man on a journey. And there's something about that that actually not only humanized him, but I think cast a richer and more hopeful vision even for me in my own journey with these things.
You know, one of the things about Vanier in general is he brings such a realism to these things. You know, he's the one that told Henry to leave the Ivy League and to come pastor some of his communities. Mm-hmm. You know, Vanier started the Arch communities. Had a lifetime of serving people with disabilities. And so he has seen volunteers come every summer and every, you know, they show up who are very idealistic about what this is going to be like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Jean knows there's nothing idealistic about caring for someone that can only scream. And when they scream, all you know is your hatred. And there's nothing romantic about sitting there trying not to hate this person that you're supposed to love. And you know, I think so much of his realism is what's so missing for so many of us that have grown up in evangelicalism, where we have so often accepted a kind of idealistic vision of ministry and of power and the Christian life in general. And Vanier wants to say, no, in the Christian life, you're going to be confronted with your hatred. Mm. In the Christian life, you're going to be confronted with how little you are interested in Jesus and what he's about. Mm. In the Christian life, you're going to be confronted with the fact that you don't care about the cross. And I think that what's beautiful about that is he could see someone like Nouwen, who struggled so mightily to live in that way, and even in his failures, see a real grace that, yeah, yes, but he had given himself to it. And that's what ultimately matters. Mm. And that time, I mean, it was just such a, Vanier has been one of my heroes for a long time now. And to have someone who is just, has to be one of the warmest, kindest person that I've ever met in my life, it speaks so powerfully into the realism of relationships and of the Christian life in general. It just struck me as like, this is a much needed tonic for the soul of evangelicalism.
That reminds me, there's this great phrase that last year when I interviewed Ann Voskamp, she dropped that she doesn't trust leaders without a limp. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's really what came to me as I was reading about Henry and his struggles and how that fits so beautifully in what the book is about. And, you know, over and over again in the book, you emphasize our weaknesses and the power that comes from our weaknesses and operating out of our weaknesses and what that really looks like embodied in a leader and a person, and how, you know, those pastors so often that speak at those conferences are, they're the opposite of walking with a limp. Mm-hmm. You know, they look like people who don't have problems or struggles at all so often, which, you know, one is untrue. And maybe we shouldn't be so quick to give a platform to people who are covering up their limps, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the passage that comes to mind is the kind of the famous hall of faith, you know, kind of passage in Hebrews, right? And we evangelicals, I think in general, my, you know, myself included, even as a pastor, we struggle to find our way into the Old Testament, but one of our lenses in usually is, well, there's a whole lot of heroes who do kind of like, you know, Spider-Man and Batman kind of stuff, and let's find them, right? And so you got David, and you've got Abraham, and you've got Noah, and you've got Moses, and you know, we tend to pick out the characters and the figures. And what's interesting about that passage in as the writer of Hebrews kind of reflects on the faith of these individuals and these stories is there's this kind of climactic verse that I think we tend to gloss over pretty quickly, and in which the writer says they were all made powerful in their weakness. They were all made strong in their weakness. And they demonstrated over and over again God's glory, God's power, God's might, God's fame. Right? And the main character in the Old Testament, of course, is none of them, right? It's and thank goodness it's God. He's the hero. But I think if we reappropriate our lens and look at the stories of these figures through the writer of Hebrews kind of framing for us, things begin to light up. I mean, Moses, here's a failure, you know, a murderer hiding out in the desert, running away, who certainly isn't someone you would normally think to choose to come back and be the spokesperson, the struggles with speaking. Here's David, and his moral failings are laid bare before all in the text. And, you know, I even think of a figure like Samson and what we tend to do in the reading of that story. You know, there's nothing in that story that tells us anything about him looking like He-Man, nothing. But every one of our pictures and renditions of him is like he's a UFC fighter, right? But the truth is there's nothing in the biblical text that unveils that. And the truth as well is it's a story about someone who is incredibly unfaithful, who mm-hmm. rejects God's way, who rebels, who lives in unfaithfulness, and yet God still accomplishes his providential ends and goal, right? It's not a story about someone who does it all right and wow, we can look at him as a shining example. And I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, of course, if we pull that into the New Testament, not only in the life of Jesus, but again, if we focus on Paul, and as Paul talks about that, I glory in my weaknesses, right? For Paul, it wasn't about kind of moping about like Eeyore and saying, man, woe is me. But it was a recognition that it's in these very places, places of weakness, places of frailty, places of genuine failure, places where we have fallen short, where if we move in dependence upon Christ, we can actually demonstrate to the world around us something else is operative here. Something else is doing the work here. There's a power here that is not known to us. What could it be? And that is what we need more of in our leaders today. And I mean, and I say that for myself as well as a pastor, you know, as you know, not kind of an exhibitionism of my weaknesses, just kind of letting everyone know all the time all my failings, but a genuine kind of staying present to the truth that I need Christ, and demonstrating that to others, that God's glory and power and might be known, that the real hero of the story would be demonstrated in my own life.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think culturally speaking, you know, one of the things that I think is difficult is that we're at a cultural point where I think there's such a fear among many, particularly evangelicals right now. There's a fear of kind of quote unquote losing the culture, whatever that means. Mm. There's a fear of being on the kind of other side of a culture that at least accepts to some degree Christianity. There's a fear of what might happen. And all this fear generates this sense of we need to respond and it needs to be powerful. We need to win. We need to be safe. We need to whatever it is. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is we because we're living out of that fear, we're giving ourselves to a mode of power that is in and of itself worldly and therefore both dehumanizing as well as undermining the kind of fruit that we're required in the kingdom. And I think there's the way of Jesus. It just doesn't offer us any quick fixes. And so there's a sense of, yeah, if I give myself to this way, will it actually work? You know, if I give myself to this way of the Christian life, to this way of doing ministry, to this way of relationships, 20 years from now, will it actually bear fruit? And you think of Paul's phrase, do not grow weary in doing good. There's a sense where I think we're a bit weary. We're afraid to trust in the way of Jesus ultimately, because at the core, we're worried that it won't work.
Yeah. And you know, Shane, I think it's, I guess a final thought on that note is it is such a paradigm shift though, isn't it? And what a gestalt for the soul. I think of the words of John 15, abide in me and I in you. Apart from me, you can do nothing, but if you abide in me, you'll bear much fruit, right? And it's this crazy notion that actually depending upon ourselves, relying upon our own gifts and abilities and resources is in the kingdom the only actual place of weakness. Mm. Right? That's the incredible notion, is that when we depend upon ourselves and our own resources and faculties in the kingdom, we can do nothing. But when we abide in Christ, when we depend upon him in the truth of our weakness, this is the place of true power. But of course, it's a power that looks foolish to the world, as Paul says. It's a power that looks weak and feeble, but it is the power of God for the salvation of the world.
I thought Eugene Peterson really tied it all together, and he was one of the people that you met with and visited. So first of all, how awesome is Eugene Peterson?
Yeah, totally right.
How cool is that? You got to spend some time with him. But he said something to the effect of, like, we have to think about how we define success. Mm-hmm. And I just think, you know, as Jesus followers, what it means to be a successful person has got to look completely different than what the world says it means to be a successful person. And what it means to be a successful church has got to be different than, you know, filling up a stadium with our church members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or those kind of grand, you know, things that we look up to other churches about. It's the success has got to be really redefined within the church and within God's people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, that I'm confronted as a pastor, even still, as I'm still tempted by these things, that I'm confronted with this reality that if we kind of apply our metrics for success on Jesus' ministry, he's an abysmal failure. I mean, that there's a confronting reality to them. I mean, here, this whole thing grows to a moment where he's hanging on a cross and there's one guy there and much of his other disciples have left and the crowds have turned on him. And I think both Eugene and Dallas, I think both those chapters, there's a real thread through both of them. Both of them want to reorient our understanding of success. And I think they, along with us, would want to say, you know, big inherently isn't bad. More people coming to salvation or a church growing in size and the Spirit of God moving, these things aren't inherently bad, but it's the desire to kind of cultivate the big and to define our success along the lines of the big that is where we get ourselves in trouble. And I think the primary distinction that both Eugene and Dallas want to make is success versus faithfulness.
Yes.
That in the kingdom, the definition of success is faithfulness to Christ and his way. And again, we want to stop short of saying that's always going to be small, right? Or that the end goal is, you know, as if we kind of overly principalize Jesus' life ministry and say, well, that means you're going to end up a martyr and there's going to be one friend with you or something, you know? No, not at all, right? But I think it is this stark reality that, as Dallas said in our interview with him, that we leave the outcomes up to the Lord. Those are in his hands. We can entrust them to him. But our task is to be faithful to Christ, to his way, to the gospel. And ultimately, for me as a pastor specifically, to what Eugene would call kind of working the angles of my ministry, right? There's some simple tasks I'm called to be given to prayer, to caring for souls, to shepherding, and to faithfully proclaiming the word of Jesus and faithfully proclaiming the gospel. And the outcomes are in his hands.
Yeah. And I just think, particularly Eugene, but even Dallas as well, that one of the things those chapters have done for me and those seasons have done for me is, you know, I used to, when I saw, you know, inevitably some celebrity pastor has a moral failing and it's all over the news, and I used to get so angry at these kind of things. And now, after talking with them specifically, I feel sorry for the people who are now caught up in this power struggle, because the worldly power is always dehumanizing. And if the church gets caught up in it, the people who are being dehumanized most readily are going to be the pastors. And the amount of pastors I know who are so caught up in, if I don't stay up on the latest conference, I'm going to be meaningless. If I'm not up to par with, you know, the whatever sermons my people are podcasting, if we're not as, you know, whatever it is, like, there's this sense of desperation. And I remember Dallas saying to us, he said, you know, 100 years ago, you could be a bad preacher and still been considered a faithful pastor.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know if that's even possible today. And that's like, wow, the kind of pressure that puts on, especially since, you know, your people can podcast someone better than you. That's just no true, matter. Right? And they are, you know, it's like, how do we not give in to the temptation of I've got to keep up now? And, you know, that, you know, I want to have a lot of patience for, and I, at the same time, I want to be able to name evil when I see it, but I want to be really gracious to those people who have given into it, because one, I know I'm capable of that, but also I know their souls have been warped by this and they haven't been left unaffected. They're not just these pastors nefariously looking to kind of be worldly, right? And it is truly warping our souls. And there's so many pastors that have been left in the wake of this that I think we need to help reconstruct our expectations of power in general and success in general so that we can actually think about leadership and ministry and church well.
Mm. Those pastors seem to also be some of the loneliest too, I think.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yes.
Special mercy and special grace for them. Mm. Well, Jamin and Kyle, I've had such a good time talking with you. Thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Thanks, man. It was great being with you.
Appreciate it, Shane. Good to be with you, brother.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.